A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about the institutional plumbing of development finance. Where do development finance institutions and development banks actually sit on the spectrum between pure philanthropy and commercial lending? And what about concessional capital versus catalytic capital? Two terms that get thrown around like they're synonyms, but really aren't. The core question is, who bridges the gap when philanthropy is too small and commercial capital is too scared? The cool question is, what does this institutional plumbing actually do? And why does it matter for anyone who cares about global development?
That's 2% of the gap. You could triple every foundation's giving and you'd still barely make a dent. Commercial capital is sitting on the sidelines because the risk-adjusted returns in frontier markets don't pencil out for institutional investors. So someone has to stand in the middle and absorb enough risk to make the math work.
Which is where we find this strange hybrid creature, the development finance institution. Part bank, part aid agency, part insurance underwriter. And the taxonomy is genuinely confusing because the labels don't do what they say on the tin.
So let's map the landscape before we get into the mechanics. On one end, you have pure philanthropy, grants with no expectation of return. On the other end, you have commercial lending, market rate returns, risk-adjusted, no impact mandate. In between, you have impact investing, which targets market rate or near-market returns, but with intentional social or environmental outcomes. Development finance institutions and multilateral development banks occupy this middle ground, but they're not one thing. There's a whole institutional ecosystem, and it has its market rate arm, the IBRD, which lends at commercial rates to middle-income countries. Same institution, same building in Washington, completely different financial logic depending on which window you're looking through. First, the multilateral development banks, the World Bank, the African Development Bank, the Asian Development Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank. These are sovereign-backed, AAA-rated institutions. Their shareholders are governments, which means they can borrow on capital markets at extremely low rates and then on-lend to developing countries.
Let's map this territory. On one end, you've got pure philanthropy. Grants, 100% subsidy, no expectation of return. On the other end, pure commercial lending. Market rates, full risk pricing, profit maximization. They're the blue chip end of development finance.
Second tier, bilateral development finance institutions. These are owned by individual donor governments. FMO in the Netherlands, Proparco in France, DEG in Germany, the British International Investment, formerly CDC Group. They operate commercially in the sense that they make loans and equity investments expecting a return, typically 2-5% per annum, but their mandate is development impact first. They're the workhorses of private sector development in frontier markets.
The third tier?
National development banks, KfW in Germany, BNDES in Brazil, China Exim. These have hybrid mandates. They do domestic development lending, but also significant international project finance, often tied to their country's strategic interests. China Exim, for instance, has lent more to Africa in the last decade than the World Bank has. The skeptic's response is, if the returns are market rate, the intentionality is just marketing. You're a commercial investor who's good at PR.
Sounds impressive, until you notice that about 60% of that went to upper-middle-income countries, not the poorest places where capital is scarcest.
That's the fundamental tension. DFIs have a dual mandate, development impact and financial sustainability. They have to earn enough return to stay capitalized. The development mandate pushes them toward riskier, poorer countries. The financial mandate pulls them toward safer, middle-income ones. Guess which mandate usually wins? Third, national development banks, like BNDES in Brazil or KfW in Germany. They're domestically focused but operate on similar principles.
The core tension that defines all of them.
Let's start with the most misunderstood tool in their arsenal. They need to be profitable enough to be sustainable. Most of them carry AAA or AA credit ratings, but not so profitable that they abandon their development mandate. It's a permanent balancing act. Under the IMF and World Bank definition, a loan is concessional if the grant element exceeds 35%.
The politics of that are fascinating. You've got a DFI reporting record profits, and the headline in the donor country's newspaper isn't "Development Bank Excels at Capital Management." It's "Your tax dollars are making bank off the world's poor."
For loans to low-income countries, the threshold is 45%. It's building its capital base so it can lend more.
They're not just government-run charities with a banking license, which is what a lot of people assume.
IDA's 20th replenishment, finalized in 2024, was $93 billion. But here's the interesting part. Only $23 billion of that was actual donor contributions. The remaining $70 billion comes from market leverage. IDA issues bonds backed by donor guarantees and the repayments from previous loans. The IVRD bond is one of the most reliable instruments in global fixed income. Pension funds in Tokyo and Zurich hold World Bank bonds not because they care about development, but because they're AAA rated and pay reliably.
Though the fact that they're disciplined doesn't mean they're not subsidized. And that subsidy mechanism, concessional capital, is where things get interesting. What actually makes a loan concessional?
The concessionality comes from the subsidy. The donor governments are effectively paying the difference between what it costs IDA to raise the money and what the borrowing country pays. A DFI steps in and offers the same loan at 4%. That 14 percentage point spread is the concession, a deliberate subsidy baked into the loan terms. Let me give you a concrete example. In 2018, the African Development Bank structured something called Room 2 Run, a $100 million securitization of existing African infrastructure loans.
That 14% difference isn't just generosity, it's a policy tool.
Once that cushion was in place, commercial investors, pension funds, insurance companies put in the remaining $91 million. The solar company in Kenya can now afford to expand into rural areas where the customer base is poorer and the infrastructure costs are higher. Without that concessional pricing, the project never pencils out.
Here's what I want to understand. How do they actually set that rate? Is there a formula, or is it basically negotiation?
The OECD's 2024 blended finance report found the average leverage ratio is closer to 1 to 1.5, not 1 to 4, not 1 to 10, 1 to 1.5. Most DFIs have a reference rate, typically based on their own cost of borrowing plus an administrative margin, and then they apply a subsidy element that reflects the development impact they expect. It raises an uncomfortable question. If concessional capital isn't actually crowding in much commercial capital, what is it doing? A loan with a concessionality level above 35% is generally considered concessional. Below that, it's just a slightly cheaper than market loan.
There's actually a regulatory definition. It's not just vibes.
The structure uses about $1.5 billion in concessional capital. One specific deal, a $50 million distributed renewable energy facility in Nigeria. A concessional first loss tranche of $12.5 million enabled $37.5 million in commercial debt for off-grid solar companies. If there's no functioning commercial loan market in a given country, which is true in many of the places DFIs operate, what exactly is the market rate you're measuring your concession against?
Which brings us to the term everyone conflates with concessional, catalytic capital. Daniel's prompt specifically asks about the relationship between the two, and you can hear the frustration in the question. These terms get used interchangeably, and they really shouldn't be.
I'm glad you flagged this, because the distinction matters enormously. Concessional capital is about pricing, below market returns. Concessionality alone doesn't solve pipeline quality. You can make money as cheap as you want. If there aren't enough bankable projects with competent management teams, the capital just sits there.
Which brings us to the second concept Daniel raised, catalytic capital. And this is where the distinction really matters.
Concessional capital is defined by its below-market terms. Catalytic capital is defined by its intent. It's capital that accepts disproportionate risk or lower returns specifically to unlock other capital that wouldn't otherwise flow.
Give me an example of concessional capital that isn't catalytic.
A DFI makes a below-market rate loan to a middle-income country for a road project that a commercial bank would have financed at a higher rate. The most elegant example of catalytic capital that isn't concessional is the International Finance Facility for Immunization, or IFFIM. Since 2006, IFFIM has raised $6.5 billion from bond markets. These are regular bonds, market rates, regular maturities. The catalytic mechanism is that they're backed by long-term sovereign donor pledges. The UK, France, and other governments have legally committed to make payments over 20 years.
Catalytic capital, that isn't concessional.
Much rarer, but it exists. Imagine a foundation that provides a first loss guarantee to a fund investing in affordable housing in Colombia. $6.5 billion of immediate funding, backed by $12.5 billion in long-term pledges. That's catalytic capital doing exactly what it's supposed to do, converting future promises into present cash without requiring below-market returns. The bonds pay market rates. The investors get what they signed up for. The only subsidy is the sovereign guarantee.
Which is a real subsidy. If the UK defaults on its IFFM commitments, bondholders still get paid from the structure's reserves. But it's not a below-market loan. It's a completely different mechanism.
Now let's talk about where this breaks down, because the system has some real pathologies. The missing middle problem is a big one. DFIs historically lend to sovereign governments or large corporations, ticket sizes above $10 million. But small and medium enterprises in frontier markets need $50,000 to $2 million. That's too small for DFIs, too risky for local banks. Catalytic capital is supposed to fill this gap through intermediary funds. At the very bottom, you've got a $10 million catalytic tranche provided by a foundation or a DFI that absorbs the first 10% of any losses.
If the fund loses $5 million, the catalytic tranche eats all of it. The commercial investors at the top don't lose a cent.
The guarantee meant that if half the loans defaulted, USAID would cover the losses. That partial guarantee enabled the bank to lend to over 200 SMEs it would otherwise have rejected. By absorbing the risk that commercial investors won't touch. Currency risk, political risk, liquidity risk, early stage project risk, it changes the risk return profile of the entire fund. That's the theory. And it works sometimes, but here's the darker side.
Catalytic capital isn't free money. It's expensive risk insurance provided by mission-driven institutions that are willing to take losses. Commercial investors won't.
That's the right way to think about it. And this is where the magic of blended finance comes in. A $10 million catalytic grant from a foundation can unlock $90 million in commercial capital, a 9-to-1 leverage ratio. This is the zombie project problem. Concessional capital can keep unviable projects alive because the cost of capital is so low that the discipline of market pricing disappears.
Though the 9-to-1 ratio is the optimistic case, what's the actual average?
Projects that would be laughed out of a commercial bank's loan committee chug along for years because the subsidy masks the fundamental economics. And that 4-to-1 includes a lot of vehicles that are mobilizing capital from other development finance institutions, not from purely commercial investors. Then there's the additionality problem, which might be the most damning critique of the whole system.
The billions to trillions narrative. The idea that a little bit of catalytic capital can unlock a flood of commercial investment is partly aspirational.
It's a vision, not a current reality. And the gap between the vision and the reality is where most of the interesting debates in development finance are happening right now.
Let's talk about a real example of this in action. The African Development Bank's Room to Run transaction.
You've got DFIs competing with commercial banks to finance a solar farm in Mexico or a port in Brazil. Perfectly viable projects that could get market rate financing, while the actual frontier markets where no commercial bank will touch get ignored. The AFDB had a portfolio of loans to African banks, loans that were performing fine but were sitting on the AFDB's balance sheet and consuming its lending capacity. The incentives are perfectly designed to produce this outcome. DFI professionals are evaluated on portfolio performance. If you make a bunch of risky loans in Chad that default, your career suffers.
The AFDB essentially said, "We'll take the first losses, you take the rest."
It was a $1 billion synthetic securitization, the first of its kind for a portfolio of African bank loans. The AFDB provided a first loss guarantee, meaning it agreed to absorb the initial losses if any of the underlying loans defaulted. $10.3 billion in pledges. As of early 2025, only 35% had been disbursed. The concessionality requirements, very low interest rates, very long tenors, created what evaluators call a use-it-or-lose-it dynamic.
The key word there is synthetic. They didn't actually sell the loans, they sold the risk of the loans.
Right. A synthetic securitization transfers credit risk without transferring the underlying assets. The loan stayed on the FDB's books, but the risk of default was partially transferred to private investors. The GCF's own independent evaluation unit has documented this repeatedly, and yet the pledges keep coming because no donor government wants to be seen as the one that walked away from climate finance for the developing world.
We've got concessional capital that often doesn't crowd in much commercial money. A huge chunk of DFI investments that aren't additional. Zombie projects sustained by subsidized rates. And a missing middle that can't get funded despite all the institutional machinery designed to serve it.
Yet, and this is what makes the topic difficult rather than just an exercise in cynicism, there are places where none of this works without concessional capital. The off-grid solar sector in sub-Saharan Africa literally would not exist without it. The first loss tranches and guarantees created a market where none existed. Today, there are companies serving millions of customers who would otherwise be burning kerosene. The concessional capital didn't distort a market, it built one. It's not that the loans were bad, it's that they were tying up capital that could be deployed elsewhere.
It's balance sheet optimization, development bank style.
And that's not a criticism, it's how banks work. The innovation was finding private investors willing to take African bank credit risk at a price that made sense for both sides. The catalytic element, the FDB's first loss guarantee, was what made that possible.
Concessional and catalytic capital can genuinely unlock private investment at scale. But here's the uncomfortable question. Does it actually work in practice? Not in theory, not in the pitch decks, in the real world, with real projects and real outcomes.
The evidence is mixed, and this is where the conversation gets honest. Let's start with a success story. The Global Energy Transfer Feed-in Tariff Program in Uganda, GETFIT, ran from 2013 to 2020. It used about $50 million in concessional capital to subsidize feed-in tariffs for renewable energy projects. That third question is the one almost nobody asks. Concessional capital should have a sunset clause. It should be designed to phase itself out as the market matures.
Additionality was actually demonstrated. They financed things that wouldn't have happened otherwise.
That's the gold standard for development finance, proving additionality. And GETFIT nailed it. The $50 million in concessional capital mobilized roughly $450 million in private investment. That's a 9-to-1 leverage ratio, which is excellent by blended finance standards. The key design feature was that the subsidy was structured as a top-up payment per kilowatt-hour generated, not as an upfront grant. The uncomfortable answer is that a lot of the institutional design points toward perpetuation. DFIs need to stay capitalized. Their staff need careers. The donor agencies need visible projects to justify their budgets to parliaments.
It's not all GETFITs out there.
Far from it. Let me give you the counterexample. Mozambique's tuna fishing fleet, a project funded in part by the European Investment Bank and other development finance institutions. Concessional loans were used to finance a fleet of fishing vessels that turned out to be commercially non-viable. The project failed. For practitioners, there are some useful resources. The Convergence Blended Finance Database is free and has over 800 real deal structures. You can see exactly how different transactions layered their capital.
The white elephant problem. Concessional loans for large infrastructure projects that look great on a spreadsheet in Brussels and fall apart on the ground in Maputo.
This isn't an isolated case. The transaction costs of structuring blended finance vehicles can be prohibitive, often 5 to 10% of the total deal size. When you're trying to mobilize a $20 million fund, spending $2 million on lawyers and consultants to structure the capital stack starts to look questionable.
There's also the crowding out critique. When DFIs lend at concessional rates, do they displace local commercial banks that can't compete with subsidized pricing?
The risk premium the market would demand is infinite, meaning the market simply won't participate at any price. Concessional capital is the only tool that can break that logjam. If a local bank would have made that loan anyway at 18% and the DFI steps in at 4%, you haven't added anything. You've just replaced a commercial lender with a subsidized one and distorted the local market in the process.
Each replenishment is a negotiation where donor countries extract promises and the bank extracts commitments. Nobody in that negotiation is asking whether the whole model should be replaced.
That's where the newer outcome-based mechanisms get interesting. Development impact, bonds, DIBs, flip the model.
Though I'd imagine there are cases where the local bank wasn't going to make the loan at any rate, where the DFI is filling a gap, not crowding anyone out.
If the program delivers the outcomes, the investors get their money back plus a return. If it doesn't, they lose their investment. Every DFI project document includes a section on additionality, and I have never read one that said, this project would have happened anyway without us. The incentives to overclaim are structural.
Which brings us to the measurement problem more broadly. How do you quantify development impact in a way that's comparable across projects?
Advanced market commitments are another variation. The best known example is the pneumococcal vaccine, AMC, that Gavi used, where donors committed to purchase vaccines at a fixed price if manufacturers developed them, creating a guaranteed market that justified the R&D investment. A DFI might report that it improved the lives of 10 million people, but what does that actually mean? Measured against what baseline? Over what time frame?
The incentives for DFI staff don't necessarily push toward rigorous measurement.
It works much less well for something like institution building or governance reform. How do you write an outcome contract for improved regulatory quality? Who verifies it? Over what time horizon? If you're a loan officer at a DFI, your performance review probably looks at your portfolio's default rate, not at whether you maximize development impact per dollar of subsidy. The capital stack framework is useful here too.
The safe middle path. It's the development finance equivalent of a cover band. You're not going to bomb, but you're not going to change the world either.
The two mechanisms aren't substitutes. They're complementary layers in a more sophisticated structure. Your staff, your systems, your institutional culture, everything is built around the concession.
Are there any examples of institutions that actually made that transition successfully?
If you separated the reporting, middle-income portfolio versus low-income portfolio, you'd expose the cross-subsidization. The middle-income deals are propping up the returns so the low-income deals can exist. That's not necessarily bad, but it should be transparent.
Sunlight as disinfectant.
The other part is recognizing that some of the most effective development finance doesn't look like finance at all. Technical assistance, helping a local bank in Ghana build the credit assessment capacity to lend to SMEs, can be more catalytic than a $50 million credit line. But technical assistance is unglamorous, hard to measure, and doesn't generate the big announcement numbers that DFI CEOs want.
The glockenspiel of corporate approachability. But in development finance, it's the big-ticket loan announcement that makes the press release, not the three-year project to train loan officers.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact. The DFI provides concessional financing, but the subsidy only kicks in when a household is actually connected to the grid and verified by an independent auditor. If the connections don't happen, the concession doesn't materialize.
You're shifting the risk from the funder to the implementer. If you don't deliver, you don't get the subsidy.
And this aligns incentives in a way that traditional concessional lending doesn't. The implementer has a powerful reason to actually achieve the development outcome, not just to deploy the capital and move on. It's the bridge between the development finance world and the impact investing world, bringing the pay-for-performance logic of impact bonds into the concessional capital space.
The challenge, I assume, is that measuring outcomes is expensive and slow.
Let's leave it with this. The goal of development finance is to make itself unnecessary. Every concessional dollar should be working toward a world where it's no longer needed.
Which brings us to the meta question. Are we, as a global community, actually willing to be honest about the subsidies these institutions require and the trade-offs they entail?
I think the answer is, not yet, but the conversation is shifting. For a long time, development finance operated in a kind of happy fog. Everyone agreed the mission was noble, nobody looked too closely at the results. The rise of impact investing has changed that. When you're asking commercial investors to put money into blended finance vehicles, they demand rigor. The challenge for anyone in this space, whether you're deploying capital, designing policy, or just trying to understand where your tax dollars go, is to hold both truths at once.
The commercial investors are forcing a discipline that the development community never imposed on itself.
And there's a real tension there, because the development community's response is often, you don't understand how hard it is to measure impact in fragile states. Which is true. But it's also true that it's hard to measure has been an excuse for, we're not really measuring, for decades.
For someone listening who's involved in this world, an impact investor, a philanthropist, a policymaker, what's the concrete takeaway?
Let me offer four. First, for impact investors, understand the capital stack of any fund you invest in. If there's no concessional or catalytic tranche, the fund is either taking on more risk than it's disclosing, or it's not reaching the hardest to finance projects. A fund that claims to be doing frontier market impact investing with purely commercial capital is either being dishonest or is about to learn a painful lesson.
Second, for philanthropists, your grant dollars are most powerful when used as catalytic first loss capital, not as direct project funding. A $1 million catalytic grant can unlock $10 million in commercial capital. A $1 million project grant just funds one project. The leverage math is overwhelming.
Third, for policymakers, the next frontier is standardizing impact measurement, so concessional capital can be priced rationally. The EU's Sustainable Finance Disclosure Regulation is a template, but it needs adaptation for development contexts. Right now, every DFI measures impact differently, which makes comparison impossible and allocation inefficient.
Fourth, the insight, development finance is not a compromise between charity and capitalism. It's a distinct third category with its own logic, its own risks, and its own accountability structures. Treating it as charity light or capitalism with a heart misses the point entirely. It's a system designed to do something neither charity nor capitalism can do alone. Finance development outcomes in places where the market won't go and grants can't scale.
That system is under enormous strain right now. Climate adaptation needs a loan are estimated at $340 billion per year by 2030. The current blended finance market is around $200 billion. That's orders of magnitude too small.
The question isn't whether these institutions work. It's whether they can scale fast enough, and whether we're willing to have an honest conversation about the subsidies they require.
There's an emerging phenomenon worth watching, concessional capital as a service. Specialized intermediaries. Convergence, the blended finance network, is the leading example. That match catalytic capital providers with commercial investors. They handle the structuring, the due diligence, the impact measurement. It's an attempt to professionalize what has historically been an ad hoc, relationship-driven system.
Which could solve one of the biggest bottlenecks, the transaction costs. If you can standardize the structuring process, you can bring down that 5-10% overhead and make blended finance viable for smaller deals.
The current system works reasonably well for $100 million infrastructure projects. It works terribly for the $5 million off-grid solar project in rural Uganda that might have enormous development impact but can't justify $1 million in legal fees.
Where does this leave us? I keep coming back to the honesty question. We've built this elaborate institutional machinery. DFIs, MDBs, concessional windows, catalytic tranches, blended finance vehicles, and it does real things. It has built real markets. The off-grid solar industry in Africa, which now provides electricity to hundreds of millions of people, was substantially de-risked by concessional and catalytic capital in its early stages.
That's a genuine success story. 15 years ago, off-grid solar in sub-Saharan Africa was essentially non-existent as a commercial market. DFIs and development banks provided the early-stage capital and the risk absorption that allowed companies like M-Copa and D-Lite to prove their business models. Now, it's a multi-billion dollar industry attracting purely commercial investment.
Alongside that success, you've got the Mozambique tuna fleet. You've got the crowding out problem in India. You've got DFI staff optimizing for career safety rather than development impact. You've got measurement frameworks that are still, charitably, works in progress.
You've got a financing gap that keeps growing. $2.5 trillion annually for the SDGs. $340 billion for climate adaptation. The institutional machinery we've built is impressive, but it's not remotely adequate to the scale of the challenge.
Which is why the most important question isn't, do these institutions work? The most important question is, are we willing to be honest about what they actually do, what they cost, and what trade-offs they require?
Because if we're not honest about the subsidies, we can't make rational decisions about how to allocate them. If we pretend concessional capital is just smart investing, we'll undersubsidize the projects that need the most support. If we pretend it's just charity, we'll oversubsidize and crowd out commercial markets. The truth is in the uncomfortable middle.
That uncomfortable middle is exactly where Daniel's question placed us. These institutions aren't philanthropy. They aren't capitalism. And understanding them requires grappling with the tension rather than resolving it.
It's the financial equivalent of quantum superposition. They're both charitable and commercial until you observe them, at which point you have to pick a metric and live with the consequences of your choice.
That might be the nerdiest thing you've ever said on this show.
I regret nothing.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1720s, a naturalist cataloging mineral specimens from the Seychelles archipelago documented a population of 17 distinct meteoritic fragments embedded in granitic formations, meaning roughly one meteorite fragment for every 27 square kilometers of the island's exposed surface area at the time.
Right.
One meteorite fragment for every 27 square kilometers. I'll be sure to bring a measuring tape next time I'm in the Indian Ocean.
The question that keeps me up at night. And I suspect it's the question that should keep the development finance world up at night, is whether we can scale this system honestly. Not whether we can scale it at all. The money will flow. The institutions will grow. The deals will get done. But whether we can scale it with genuine additionality, with rigorous measurement, with a willingness to admit when we're crowding out local markets or financing white elephants, that's the test.
The answer will depend on whether we treat development finance as a discipline or a religion. A discipline admits failure, learns, and improves. A religion defends its orthodoxies and punishes heretics. Right now, the development finance community contains elements of both.
This has been my Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want to hear more conversations like this one, find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Leave us a review if you enjoyed the episode. It helps other people discover the show. We'll be back next week with another prompt from Daniel.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.